funding for THINK comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
We hear every single day about intractable conflicts in the world, between Israelis and Palestinians, between radical Islamists and the Democratic West, between, let's face it, Republicans and Democrats in Washington. From a distance, their inability to forge peaceful solutions can look depressing, even hopeless. But think about your own relationships. There are things we argue about over and over with our partners without ever truly resolving them. Why can't we always forge agreements, even with the people we love? This is THINK on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The reality is that those national and global scale conflicts may have more in common than we realize with the persistent clashes in our personal lives. And they may all be helped by the same counterintuitive advice, starting with the idea that we should stop trying to eliminate emotion from our interactions. In May, I spoke with Daniel Shapiro, an associate professor of psychology at the Harvard Medical School and founder of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. His new book is called Negotiating the Non-Negotiable: How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Daniel, welcome to THINK.
Thanks so much. Great to talk with you.
What qualifies as an emotionally charged conflict?
Whew. It's that. It's that feeling you get when you, you know, someone says or does something to you and you start to feel the emotions flare. You start to feel the anger, the frustration, maybe the seething resentment, the shame underneath it. It's just any conflict that feels somewhat unbearable.
One big problem with those emotional divides is that they create this sense that it's like you versus me or us versus them, when the conflict, as you explained it, actually exists in the space between the two parties. Can you tell us more about that?
This is a crucial distinction. People often define their identities through what I call their core identity, all the characteristics that define you as a person or as a group. What are your beliefs? What are your values? And so on. That's a part of who you are. There's this other part. When you're in relation, if you imagine two stick figures sitting on a piece of paper, each of those stick figures has a core identity. You can give it a name, John and Harry. And yet there's also the relationship between those two figures. That's what I call your relational identity. And it's in that space, that relational space, that a lot of the emotional action tends to happen in an emotionally charged conflict.
So if the action happens between people in that space, there's room for us to retain our identity and still work through the conflict without necessarily having to sacrifice a big part of ourselves.
Exactly. Exactly. So and just to make the space more tangible, we all know it. And we talk about it all the time. When two people don't get along, we say, boy, there's something between them. Well, not. Or just the opposite, when two workers, you know, within an organization have a little thing for one another, what do we say there? We say, I think there's something between them, you know. So, there really is something to this notion of the space between us. It sometimes can feel heavy or like a wall is there. At other points in time, it feels open and fluid, loving in the best of relationships.
What is the tribe's effect, and how does it get in the way of reaching mutually satisfactory resolutions?
Through studying conflict for the past 25 years, I've come to the conclusion that there is one mindset that is more dangerous than anything else, and I call this the tribe's effect. And we all know this, and just giving a name to it, it's a divisive mindset. It's the moment that your relationship with a loved one or a colleague suddenly turns adversarial. It turns from me with you to me versus you. And at that point in time, I start defending my point of view. I completely close my ears to your point of view. I believe my side is absolutely right and legitimate, and I believe you are wrong and crazy. That's the tribe's effect, you know?
So why is tribal affiliation so important to us?
It's about our identity. It is that we all want to feel that we are somebody in this world that, I mean, to me, the core of our identity is that it's craving meaning. You know, we want to seek significance in our existence. We want to seek meaning in our life. And tribes are one powerful way of doing so. I mean, we all belong to any number of tribes, the family. We belong to a nation. We belong to an organization. And then there's some of the more repugnant tribes. You know, you have ISIS, Al-Qaeda. They're tribes in their own way. So we all want to feel included in a part of something that's bigger than ourselves, something that gives us some sort of symbolic immortality. And yet it's that same driving force that also at points causes us to bump up and, you know, bump up against or clash into another tribe.
What's interesting, I was thinking about the tribe's effect and this experience we've all had of, you know, you can have a member of your family who is driving you crazy, but the moment someone from outside your family says something about that other person, you leap to their defense, even if in a different situation you might agree that this action that this other person is taking is pretty problematic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can call my kids whatever names I want. But the second somebody else says, you know, your middle kid's a jerk, I say, excuse me.
Right, Papa Bear leaps in. Yeah.
Exactly. And interestingly, there's circles of acceptance as well. Even a second degree cousin can say something negative about my kids. I'll still feel somewhat offended, not as offended as with the third degree cousin or the friend. But I think with tribes, the fundamental principle of the tribe is loyalty. The moment that I betray my tribe is the moment my tribe casts me outside of its circle. So I think that's one of the driving reasons why we tend to protect even that which we don't see as with merit from within our circle.
Dan, there was a time in this country when there were liberal and conservative Democrats and liberal and conservative Republicans. It would be hard to argue that it's quite the same today. Have political tribes in this country become more strident?
I think we're seeing a substantial increase in polarization, both within each of the two major tribes, the Republican and Democratic Party, and certainly between tribes, between the parties as well, between these, Republican and Democratic parties. So my sense is that there is an increase in polarization there. It's working perhaps to the short-term benefit of those campaigning for the presidency. They get more loyalty. And no one within their tribal circles can criticize their tribal circles, so they really get that buy-in. At the same time, while it might be increasing the number of votes for any particular Republican or Democratic candidate, it also the danger is that it's tearing at the seams of our societal structures.
So how open to change is the core identity of a group or a tribe?
Well, core identities are not typically they're very resilient. They're not too amenable to change. The part where you really can work is through the relational identity, trying to change the relationship. So, for example, practically within the Democratic Party, within the Republican Party, and between sides, what can be done to try to improve relationships? Now, one might listen and go, it's impossible, and there might be some truth to that given the current political climate. At the same time, I think you can negotiate a lot.
So often we fear that conceding any point to somebody we're arguing with is tantamount to exposing a weakness for them to pounce on. Does that happen in practice?
It does. I don't look at negotiating as weak. I think when if you and I are in the midst of a negotiation, the goal would be to try and listen, understand each other's perspectives, understand what we care about, so we can try and formulate some sort of agreement that works for you and that works for me. My advice would be don't concede. Don't concede to anything in a negotiation to the extent you can help it. Instead, work to try and find some sort of options that can serve each side's interests to the extent possible.
I want to talk about taboos here because this is something that you say really plays into the way that our behavior is shaped by our tribal affiliation. So what are you talking about here when you talk about taboos?
So the big idea is that we have this mindset, this tribe's effect, this divisive mindset. What we found through our research that there are these set of emotional forces that tend to pull us toward that mindset in a conflict situation, and especially when our identity feels threatened. One of those emotional lures is taboos. All right. Taboos are social prohibitions. My mother-in-law called it once. She said they're the big no-nos. You know, they're the things you're not supposed to say. They're the things you're not supposed to feel in an organization or family. They're the things you are not supposed to do. So, for example, don't talk about mom's drinking. Don't talk about the fact that dad always loved you more than me. Or in the work context, don't give that boss the negative feedback. I promise you, you will not get the promotion you wanted. The problem with taboos is that these are things, if you do raise these issues, there's a danger you're going to get punished. On the other hand, if you fail to deal with these taboos, if you fail to confront them on some level, the result is the same dysfunctional patterns of behavior again and again and again and again. You get stuck.
So, as you describe it, we've got a few choices, right? We can accept taboos and say, okay, they're appropriate. We can chisel away at them, or we can tear them down entirely. How do we decide which course of action is best?
I mean, this is where I think the name of your show is a beautiful name. Think. You know?
We like it.
No, but I mean, it takes some serious reflection. Let me give you an example. So in the book, I talk about some work that we did with Israelis and Palestinians who to this day remain stuck in some of the most challenging taboos. You know, so the fear of talking to the other or naming the other with the other's name and so on. We met in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, under the auspices of the World Economic Forum. It's myself leading this program, joined by Tony Blair, who was then the head of the quartet. And we had this very influential group of leaders, privately meeting, and in small groups, they sat down and analyzed some of the key taboos affecting the conflict. And on each taboo, they asked the question, what are the pros to keeping this taboo? What are the cons? What are the pros to, you know, getting rid of it, breaking it down? And what are the cons? And what do we think we should do? And at the end of the day, they had this option. They had the taboo in their hand, written down on a piece of paper. After they talked about it, they could decide to either keep this taboo and go off outside of our, you know, the doors of our workshop and try and tear down this taboo, or they could return this little piece of paper to the middle of the room where we had a little cordoned off area, which I called the taboo territory. And they could return the taboo, that piece of paper, to that little area, and they sort of can then wash their hands of any felt moral contamination. They walk outside the room. But I think this is the opportunity that we all have in the family life, in the organization. We can decide, you know, you need to consciously think through what are the taboos that are affecting the dysfunction in this organization? Are they useful to keep? Are they dangerous to break? Maybe I should. Let me just chisel away at it a little bit and see what happens.
So a taboo might be useful to the extent that, for example, within a couple relationship, there's a taboo that both partners might share that violence is off the table. It's never okay.
Yes. Yes. And I think sometimes taboos can be very helpful. You know, so I have three beautiful little boys and I get scared to death every morning when they go out that door and I say, I love you. Goodbye. Given, you know, the unlikely, but you know, reality of our world, school violence. I think the taboo for violence has gone way too much in the wrong direction. Hmm. A lot of work we can do.
My guest is Daniel L. Shapiro, Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School and founder of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. We're talking about his new book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're listening back this hour to our May conversation with Daniel Shapiro, founder of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. We talked about his new book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Let's return to the conversation when I asked him about what we should do when we have the same argument with the same person that ends the same predictable way.
In the book, I call this the repetition compulsion. Right. It's a concept that Sigmund Freud originally coined, and I expand on it. Basic notion is that we tend to repeat the same dysfunctional patterns of behavior again and again and again and again. And we know we should not repeat them, but we do again and again. And it's incredibly difficult to break out of these patterns. They're not just habits. They become enmeshed parts of how we see ourselves, what our identity is. So as an example, I have a very good friend who was in the sort of trapped in a longstanding emotionally abusive relationship, more than 25 years. And eventually, about a month and a half ago, she finally broke out of this relationship, drove down to Washington, D.C., and lived there with some good friends. And what did she do every day? Every day. Shall I go back? Shall I go back today? Should I not go back? Oh, I feel like I should go back. Let me call him. What do you think? Obsessing over this, utterly consumed. And this is the repetition compulsion. And the strange thing about it, one of my colleagues, now deceased from Harvard Medical School, Paul Russell, he described it beautifully. He said, we are like a mosquito drawn to that fatal flame. You can't resist it. And I regret to say that this good friend, about a week and a half ago, went back to that abusive relationship. She's grown from it. But it's very difficult. It's possible to break out of the repetition compulsion. It's not easy.
So what kind of weaponry can you give us in order to possibly help us break out of that repetition compulsion? How can we recognize that we're trapped in it? Because it doesn't always even seem like we're the one. It feels like if the other person would only change, then it would be fine. And maybe your example is not ideal here of the woman in an abusive relationship. But in the everyday disagreements we have.
Even in that situation, it's still a dance. Mm-hmm. You know, she decided to go back. Even in everyday situations with spouses, with people at work, colleagues, we get back into that cycle again and again and again and again. I call it the cycle of discord. And the first and most useful step is to become aware of that cycle. Who says what? What do you feel when they, when your spouse says, hey, you forgot to do that again? How do you respond? What feeling do you get? What do you say in return? How do they respond? You can start to plot out the cycle, the typical standard cycle. Do you each confront and then you both withdraw? Does one of you attack and then the other withdraw? Once you see that cycle, it's very empowering. Now you realize that you are just, in a sense, an object reenacting a script, and you can change that script. Once you get it down on paper, and in the book I show you exactly how you can do it, you then have choice. Well, maybe normally I confront my wife after she confronts me. Next time, you know what? I'm going to try and simply appreciate her perspective before attacking back or instead of attacking back, and see how that results. You can start to play with reality than just accepting it fait accompli.
Let's talk about what it takes to see something from the other party's perspective. You know, I think the old idea is role playing, which basically, can turn into you just like doing this parody of the person you're arguing with and all the things they're doing. That's different from truly trying to understand how it looks to them.
There's something useful to role playing. To stepping into that other person's shoes, the question is, what are the tools to help you to do that? And I talk about some of those tools in the book. I call them, my colleague Roger Fisher and I call these things core concerns. And there are five of these things that are very useful to analyze both from your perspective and the other side's perspective. Two colleagues at work getting into a fight. Core concern number one, does each person feel appreciated, heard and understood and valued, yes or no? Number two, autonomy. Do I feel like I have the freedom to make decisions without you telling me what to do? And do you feel like you have the freedom to make decisions without me telling you what to do? We don't like our autonomy impinged. Core concern number three, affiliation. We all want to feel included. Do I feel like you rejected me? Does that other party feel like I'm rejecting them? Core concern number four, status. Do I feel belittled by you? Do you feel potentially belittled by me, even if I didn't mean to do it? And core concern number five, what is my role in this interaction? Do I feel like a victim at the hands of an aggressor? Do I feel like an overly powerful beast, you know, at the hands of an innocent other? What role am I playing, and is that role useful? Is it helping us in our relationship? So when and this is one of the things I often do when working with distressed CEOs, executives, families, to have them really think through from the other side's perspective, which of their core concerns might feel upset at this point in time? What do you think?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Puneet in Denton. Hi, Puneet. Puneet,
hello?
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi, this is Puneet Kumar from Applied Sciences in South Lake. Thanks for taking my call. My question is that what advice do you have to help kids deal with emotional bullying? Because as you may know, these days in schools, there's much less of physical bullying compared to more of, you know, the kids are facing emotional bullying.
What do you think, Dan?
No, well, thank you for the question. I have three kids, and they are currently in that, you know, struggle themselves. It's not easy. You know, I'd start with the broad perspective. I think prevention is crucial. We often in schools teach math. We teach science. We don't teach conflict resolution. We don't typically teach negotiation, how to help people deal with one another more effectively. And yet we also expect people, you know, some 15 years later when they go off in their professional lives, to be expert in this, and this becomes one of the primary reasons for hiring somebody. Are they able to, you know, are they emotionally savvy, and so on. So one, I would think, are there ways at the broad levels to implement programs of conflict resolution into the school system? Two would be to teach basic skills of negotiation to your child who might be dealing with bullying at this point in time. What are the options in front of this person? Just walk away, don't give them attention, try to empathize with the bully, but perhaps not get too close to that bully, get the support of teachers who might be able to help reorganize the social system. I think there are a lot of options out there, but the biggest one I'd say is prevention.
Reading your book made me think back to a discussion I had with the editor of Scientific American a few weeks ago. They did a special issue about the problem of terrorism. And one of the things that researchers have discovered is that appealing to reason in trying to convince people not to hold extremist ideologies or commit acts of terrorism is really not helpful. But giving them something to relate to emotionally back to the people that they might otherwise wish to harm can be effective. Can you talk about how this gels with what you have learned about appeals to emotion?
Yeah, so there are many different ways to influence somebody. Some people move toward logic, others toward emotion. And when it comes to issues of ideology, there are multiple strands of ways of influencing that person. I think one is through emotion, to help them somehow empathize with the other side, to recognize, no, this isn't a set of objects, you know, in Boston downtown at a marathon. This is human beings, cute little kids, you know, innocent people there. So I think that's one way of trying to influence the mind in the mindset of a terrorist or somebody who's considering committing a terrorist activity. Another way of dealing with the terrorist is to look at who are the gatekeepers? Who are the people that are helping these, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-olds understand their emotional reality? Who are the people who are sharing the ideology? And might one try to influence some of those gatekeepers to change the way they view violence and the use of violence? It's another way of trying to prevent terrorist activity from happening.
Are there added complications in cases where actual religion rather than simply culture defines what is sacred? For example, I'm thinking about the argument over abortion. Many who oppose it point to God as the source of their belief that all life is sacred. Non-religious people don't feel the same sway. On the other hand, some who support abortion rights find a woman's right to make decisions over whether or not to bear a child is sacred, but people taking their cues from religious texts might reject the fact that that is valid. So how can those two groups find common ground?
One has to speak in the language that the other can hear. There was a very esteemed colleague of mine, a lawyer, who had this unusual opportunity many years back to interview a potential terrorist, a kid, you know, probably 14, 15, before he went off to strap the bomb to his chest and explode himself and kill innocent people. The question was, what would the most effective advice be in that situation? If you had the opportunity to sit down with that kid, what would you say? What would you do? And this particular lawyer shared with me his approach. He said, I'm going to sit down with that individual, and I'm going to let this kid know you have a whole life ahead of you. You have 60, 70 years. Imagine what you could do with that life. Rather than destroying it tomorrow with a single bomb, you're in the newspaper for a day, but that's it. And yet, as I heard this lawyer's analysis and his brilliant rational idea, the thought in my head was, wow, is this really going to be an idea that this 15-year-old kid, this terrorist, can hear? And my answer was no, and at least in my own head. My sense is that the terrorist, who really is indoctrinated into an ideology, has a fundamentalist perspective of identity. In other words, they see their identity as God-given and inviolable. It cannot be changed. And yet this lawyer was coming in and saying, you know what, identity, it's constructible. You can change over time. Two very different ways of understanding identity. To me, the more effective way of affecting that kid with the bomb, you know, that potentially is going to go on his chest, is from a fundamentalist perspective, to bring in a conversation on religion, to say, well, maybe this could be interpreted slightly differently. What do these people say? What do these people say? To open up the door of possibility through the perspective, the mindset that the fundamentalist might have. And by the way, this lawyer never did get the opportunity to interview that potential suicide bomber. I don't know what happened.
Some negotiations, Dan, are trades, right? Others involve reconciliation, sometimes even forgiveness. You note that forgiving does not require forgetting. Why is that important?
Well, I'm not sure anybody would ever forgive if it meant forgetting. I think people often contrast peace and justice, and they think if you move toward peace with that other side, it comes at a sacrifice to justice. Forgiveness is a way of trying to move toward peace. I want to be at peace with you. That doesn't mean that you need to disregard the importance of justice as well. So yes, I can forgive, but I don't, you know, I'm not going to necessarily forget. The divorce, you know, the couple who, you know, one experiences one commits an act of infidelity. If they should go through the grueling process of staying together, one might forgive the other, but I'm not sure it would be wise to forget, and it certainly would be unlikely to be possible.
How can we decide whether it's better to forgive or to withhold forgiveness? Is it always better to forgive?
No. There's a, I can't recall who it is anymore. There's a quote in my book by a wonderful author who basically says he wanted to, he couldn't forgive somebody for years and years and years and years. And all of a sudden, one particular day, the authentic feeling emerged. He could forgive. I don't think you can force forgiveness. I sometimes try to force my children to forgive one another. And they'll sort of haphazardly do it. I'm teaching them the importance of forgiveness. I'm not sure they always actually authentically do it. But I think forgiveness is something that one can think about. The more you think about it, the more you open up the opportunity for it to naturally emerge. But you can't force forgiveness.
Can the ideas in your book work even if only one party to the disagreement is aware of them and willing to practice them?
100%. Absolutely. Negotiation is always a dance. Conflict is always a dance. I think the key problem we often have is that we simply react to the other side's bad behavior. They called me names. I'll call them names back. Hey, they're so irrational. You know, we see things from our perspective. We don't recognize that we are at least half of the equation in this conflict situation. Let me give you an example. Two colleagues at work having a difficult time together. They quarrel back and forth. There's tension. It's silent. It's strained. If either of them simply walks up and says, "You know what? I'm sorry for all of the challenges I've caused you over the past 3 months. I've had some difficulties at home. I don't want this to go on anymore." Now, the other person might refuse that invitation for forgiveness. However, the first person has already changed the dynamic. And so there's absolutely power in one.
We're speaking this hour with Daniel L. Shapiro, Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School and founder of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. He has a new book out called Negotiating the Non-Negotiable: How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're listening back this hour to our May conversation with Daniel Shapiro, founder of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. We talked about his new book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable: How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Let's return now to the conversation when I asked him about what constitutes a meaningful apology.
A meaningful apology, first of all, is I am taking responsibility for what I've done. And I think this becomes the most problematic part when it comes to kids, you know. So I'm acknowledging and accepting responsibility. It's honest. I'm not just telling you that I'm taking responsibility so Dad doesn't give me that glare anymore, you know. Another piece of it that often comes into play is I'm not going to do this again. So if my son goes and says, you know, "Okay, Zachary, I'm sorry," and then 2 seconds later, he hits him again in the gut, I'm not sure it was an effective apology.
Right.
And often there's also some sort of reparation that goes in as well. So in my case, I sort of force my kids to do this. You know, you have to write your brother a little note of apology so that they really do take responsibility and demonstrate I'm trying to repair. For a while, I had them try to hug each other. And the older kid just totally rejects that. He's like, "No," you know. So he'd rather just sit in his room for hours. So that wasn't quite a good idea.
Is it ever helpful to wait on compelling that apology until everybody feels a little calmer?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I think there's nothing more important than a well-timed apology. If my wife is still simmering from a conflict and I come and say, "I'm sorry," it may not, you know, may hit deaf ears at that point in time. So I think it is important to maintain some emotional sensitivity to each party's state, where they're at emotionally.
Sometimes when two individuals are arguing, one is really drawn to emotional appeals. The other wishes to make his or her case using only reason. It can be like they're speaking two different languages. So what can we do with that?
This is my mom and my dad.
Mm-hmm. You write about them in the book.
Yeah. I mean, but it absolutely is. So my mother is the consummate therapist. She doesn't have a degree in therapy, but she's, I mean, if she were on with you right now, I promise you, you'd already be crying and telling your deepest, darkest story. She's very emotionally attuned. My father is sort of the stereotypic business person. He has a big, big heart, but he feels much more comfortable in the rational realm. The challenge, I mean, the goal is in a conflict situation, how do you best connect with the other side? So if it's my father and I in the midst of a conflict situation, I might want to tailor my language, tailor my words so that he can hear them. Not too many feeling words. He's going to distance himself, perhaps unconsciously. On the other hand, when it comes to my mother, you know, I'm the one who starts to feel uncomfortable. You know, so I may want to talk more about emotions and that, you know, when talking with her about a difficult situation. At the same time, I want to ensure I still have some boundaries of protection around myself.
All right, let's talk about large-scale negotiations. There are, you know, international discussions that take place, even something like, you know, the talks between the union and management of a big company or industry. You can sit people down in a small group behind closed doors, and maybe they feel free to negotiate and they can come up with a solution. However, both sides know that they've got to go out of that little room and then face a very large room of people who have expectations and who didn't want them to budge an inch. So what do you do about that obligation that we might feel, even if what the group wants we don't actually agree with, but we feel responsible for fulfilling their wishes?
There are two. One colleague calls this the two-level game. Mm-hmm. So you have the top-level leaders at one level. And I've seen this time and again. We're sitting down with heads of state who, you know, call each other deep adversaries. They come into a room together and they're suddenly chatting, laughing, and sort of like, what's happening here? This right. doesn't make sense. It's behind closed doors. One useful element is to recognize those two layers. The leadership have their interests and then the people have theirs. And sometimes the leaders might work together to figure out, is there some sort of what we call a yesable proposition, some sort of agreement that may work for both of us and that also satisfies our armies on each side of this conflict situation as well, so we can put our weapons to rest. It takes a little creative thinking. I mean, the big idea is, how do you create the other side's victory speech? How do you create their victory speech? What would that look like so that the union can go and say, we won? We have gotten out of management everything we wanted to get out of them. And they put down their arms, and management can come along and say precisely the same thing. We won. We've gotten everything from union that we had demanded.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to David in Frisco. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris and Dr. Shapiro. My question is, does the book, which I am looking forward to getting, address long-term standing conflict between two generations in a family? And I'm referring more to a geriatric elder patriarch and his progeny, who are now grandparents even. And it just seems to be an almost intractable, irreconcilable dynamic that goes on, and I'm sure that it is not that uncommon in some families. So I was just curious, you know, you spoke about adolescents and younger people and parents. Now I'm going the other way with the question, and I'll take your response off the phone. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Now, does it focus specifically on that? No. Generally speaking, absolutely. This book is not meant to be a quick fix. It's not a quick stop for negotiation tricks. It really is trying to get at the deeper issues that make our relationships feel so non-negotiable. As I listen to your situation, one chapter in particular comes to mind. It's on what I call your mythos of identity, which is the deep narrative structuring your relationship with others in a conflict situation. And one way of trying to get, what do I mean? So sort of like, what is the core story? The way you, and how you see the relationship with the other side. Let me make this practical. One way that you can get at this is through metaphor. Imagine both generations and the conflict between them. What might be a metaphor that could describe the dynamic between those generations? Is it David versus Goliath? Or is it some other metaphor? It can be extremely powerful simply to understand the dynamics going on affecting you. And in the chapter, I then suggest you can, in fact, start to think about new ways of crafting your metaphor that can be more empowering. Quick example. I was recently talking in New York with a journalist. She was like, I don't get it. I'm like, well, let's do it. And I said, well, think about a close relationship in your life. She thought of one. And I said, well, what's the relationship like? She said, it's sort of like two beach balls that come way toward each other and then they bounce apart. And then I said, well, what causes them to come toward each other? And she looked at me puzzled and she said, I guess it's the wind. And then I said, well, what's causing the wind? And it just so happened we were in a room. There was a fan in the corner of the room. I said, might it be a fan? She said, maybe. And I said, well, who has the power to turn that fan on and off? And she looked at me and she smiled. And so this was a way of helping empower her to see her relationship from a different perspective. That's what a lot of this book is really about. How do you take these emotionally complex conflicts and without distilling the emotion out of it, how do you better understand the emotional nature of that conflict so you can take charge of it rather than it taking charge of you?
You make the point that it's really important to try to bolster relationships in between the conflict, right? When everybody's getting along, try to build in some goodwill that will serve you better later on.
I mean, this is the secret to effective conflict resolution. I think we are the boss, you know, typically sits at his desk, and just, you know, does work. And then when a conflict comes along, they try and resolve it. Well, you've missed 1,000 opportunities to improve the conflict resolution process, trying to build those good relations. The couple who waits to build their relationships until after they've had their conflict is a couple who's in the midst of problems. You know, go on those date nights and do those kinds of things. And I'm reminding myself as well as I travel with this book talk as well. I think it's those moments that are so important, even in the international realm as well. How do you help the countries and the diplomats, the business people from these different countries, really work to build those relationships, Israelis and Palestinians, as much as the rest of us?
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Russell on the line in Carrollton. Hello, Russell.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just had a quick question going back to one of your previous comments about infidelity in a marriage. After the forgiveness, and as you previously stated, I don't think you could ever forget in that situation. It seems that trust is implied with forgiveness. What are your thoughts on that?
I think trust is a complicated thing. Some see it as a button that you could turn on and off. I see it as much more textured. In the book, there's a whole chapter on how do you work through emotional pain. The first step is to really come to terms with that pain. So with infidelity, there's obviously an incredible amount of pain, feelings of betrayal, of shame, of humiliation. Step one, come to terms with that, and that takes time alone. Step two, people often skip the second step. And what I talk about in the book there is you need to mourn the loss. There is something substantial on an emotional level in situations of infidelity that has been lost on both sides, and it can never come back. You know, the notion of the whole and innocent relationship is forever broken. One needs to mourn that, mourn the loss. And only then, I think, can one start to move toward rebuilding real trust and moving toward true forgiveness, genuine apology.
How do we build what you call cross-cutting connections?
Simple and complex ways. I mean, one is just to try and build the personal connections. So, Chris, as you and I are here now, I could start just asking some basic questions. You said you have multiple kids. I might start asking about them. Mm-hmm. And then I try and relate back to that as well. Well, I have 3 kids of my own. How do you get your kids to bed? You know, so we start to have that conversation. Second way to build cross-cutting connections is through what I call structural connections. This is the notion that we are both part of some common group. And this may sound simple, but this is so powerful in terms of helping people build connections. I mean, we could spend, 5 minutes brainstorming. What do you enjoy doing on Saturdays and Sundays? You tell me, I don't know, what's your hobby?
My hobby is working.
Working,
you know
what?
And raising
that's mine
my kids.
Too. We're very alike. My hobby is working as well. Day in, day, it's my passion. Mm-hmm. But this becomes a structural connection. And truly and honestly, just simply from that, I feel a bit closer to you now. And I hope it's mutual. But through those methods, one can start to build a connection. In a conflict, there's another way we can build connection. I mean, conflict tends to divide us and the other side. One of the ways that you can build connection, even in conflict, is to approach the conflict not as a problem of the other person. It's not me versus you, Chris, but it's the two of us facing the same shared problem.
Hmm.
You're not the problem. I'm not the problem. The problem is here in that space between us. How do we deal with it? And this is the magic of effective conflict resolution. We've seen this work in helping to resolve international conflicts in our work with heads of state and others. I've seen it work with businesses, and I've seen it work in the family context. It's not me versus you. It's the two of us facing the same shared problem.
Do you believe peace in the Middle East is feasible?
Absolutely. Now, half your listeners are going to think I'm totally naive. The other three-fourths naive. The title of my book is Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, mm-hmm. and I think the first step to make that happen is to believe it's possible. If I don't believe it's possible, it will not be possible. I'm in my own mind, and I'm not going to do anything to try and make it a possibility. So I think belief in the possible, belief in the negotiable, is the essential fundamental step.
Daniel Shapiro is Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School and founder of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. His new book is called Negotiating the Non-Negotiable: How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Dan, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks so much for making time for us.
It is an honor and a pleasure to talk with you. Good luck with your work.
Thank you. Too. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.